I'm only recording this in case somebody will accuse me of having said something that I never really said. The proof is going to be right here. And speaking about the last time I was in Toronto, I met the Seidenfelds. We all ended up at the same wedding. We came from different directions. I had been in Detroit, and from Detroit I came to Toronto, and they, of course, came directly from Eretz Yisrael. The principles of halacha, in the main, are fixed. They're permanent. 39 categories of work on Shabbos, never changing. But then there's the question of applying those 39 categories of work to particular situations, and certainly we were talking about the newfangled technological inventions that appear upon the scene. The question then becomes, how are we going to use the categories of Shabbos and those principles and apply it to this new technology? But basically it's fixed. There's a real permanence to the principles of halacha. But despite the fact that there's a permanence, there's always the necessity to take a second look, to review, and to see if things have changed. There are so many areas in which this second look became extremely necessary. I would say that one of the areas where it's most necessary and is taking place all the time is in the area of halacha and medicine. 30 years ago, Poskim were extremely wary of something like heart transplants or organ transplants. I mean, we've moved 30 years ahead, and each one of these halachas has to be looked at in the light of what's taking place in the world out there. So that technology, medicine, all of these require our looking nearly constantly at halacha and medicine, halacha and technology. One of the halachic issues that, of course, has split the country or split the religious community during the course of the last, I'd say, really 30 years, the debate has been going on maybe more than 30 years, is the question of land for peace. And one of the things that at times gets me upset, there's always somebody who's going to say, Rabbi, don't talk politics. You know, we didn't come here to listen to politics. So I'm telling you, I'm talking halacha. I'm not talking politics. And the idea that that has been expressed by others, you know, that rabbis should paskin about whether you say avarachamim or not, but they don't have opinions about matters of this sort. Every cab driver in the country can have an opinion. Every uneducated chaver Knesset can have an opinion. Any corrupt politician can have an opinion. Barakovs only Shtabin can opinion that Hashan and Acharpe. Of course, we have an opinion. But what the point that I want to make is that there will be very specific points that I want to make. I think that those who were opposed to land for peace were not really understood ever. Not really understood. And I want to get to the core of that problem. What was the issue? Where weren't we understood? We were not understood to the point that I would consider a modern form of blood libel. But I'll get to that. That's heavy stuff I just now said. And it's down here. I know that it's down here. The introduction, that's enough introduction. Let's get down to the heart of it all. What I've chosen to do is, there were many halachic articles that were written on the question of land for peace. I would say the two that really represent both sides of the coin, appeared in Tumen, volume 10, the Psak Halacha of Rav Avadya Yosef, and the opposing opinion was the opinion of Rav Shaul Yisraeli Zechreinu Livracha. He, in a sense, was the one who stood up to the Psak Halacha of Rav Avadya Yosef. By the way, I'm ready to bet. Everybody was quoting Rav Avadya Yosef, you're allowed to give land for peace, land for peace. From a study of mine, not terribly scientific study, but I'm ready to stand by it. 99% of the people who quoted Rav Avadya Yosef never looked at the tshuva. And the 1% that did look at the tshuva never got to the end of the tshuva. I'm ready to say that that's a pretty scientific guess of what took place. So I think that it's important that we should take a second look. And I'm only taking one aspect of it. It's a very wide and a very broad issue. We're going to deal with one aspect. Now that aspect is a Gemara in Masechet Erev, and you have the Gemara right there. We're going to read the Gemara. The Gemara discusses other rules of warfare on Shabbos. This is a Gemara Daf Mem Hei Amar Aleph and Erevin Omar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav. Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, Nochrim Shetzor Wal Ayoros Yisrael Goyim who have besieged an Israelite city and Yotzen Aleh on Shabbos and Yotzen Aleh in B'Klei Zayin, you're not allowed to take weapons and go out in order to wage war with them. You can't go out. Listen to this. And you're not mechal Shabbos to protect Jews from goyim who have besieged the city. Wait a minute, the qualification is coming. It's coming, and it's here. Tanya nami hachi. This was also taught in a brisa. Nochrim chetzoru alor ayoris yisrael. You're not allowed to be mechal Shabbos. Bamed devarim amurim. When was this said? Kishabo aliske mamon. If they're coming to steal. If they're coming to steal objects, money, you're not allowed to be Mechal Shabbos. You have to let them take it. But if they come, if they come over a matter of lives, there is a real threat to the lives of people. So of course, Bikuach Nefesh. Yotzen Aleim B'Klei Zainon U'mechalim Aleim Asa Shabbos. You take weapons, you go out, you desecrate Shabbos, you fight off the enemy. Classic, this is it. Shabbos is of course set aside when there is Pikuach Nefesh. Now here comes another interesting, fascinating, significant qualification. U'bi'ir Hasmucha L'Sfar. If goyim are coming to city against a city that's on the border, here the halacha is, even if they come only to steal, and even if all they are coming to steal is straw and hay, kash v'tevan, not terribly valuable, but it's a border city, then the halacha is that your mechalel Shabbos, even if they're coming only for money. Ubiir hasmuchol l'sfar afilu lo bar iske nefashes, even if they're not coming over a matter of lives. El al iske tevin v'kash, they're coming over a matter of straw and stubble. Yotzim aleim b'klei zayin, and you go out with weapons of mechalam aleim es haShabbos. Your mechalel Shabbos. All right. Rashi. We're going to go to the Rashi to the right, and then we're going to come right back to the continuation of the Gemara. Rashi says, L'sfar, it's underlined. Ir shemavdelet ben gvul Yisrael l'gvul ha'umos. A city that separates between the boundary of Yisrael and the boundary of the nations. Notice very carefully, Rashi does not talk about Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't say between... it's a border city in Eretz. So he says a gvul, a boundary between goyim and Jews. And why yotzim aleim? Why do you go out and wage war against them? Shem or yul kedua? Because the goyim may capture the city. Umisham teheinocha ha'oretz likavesh lufneim. And from there it will be easier for the goyim to conquer the land. Now I'm going to explain why Rashi doesn't mention Eretz Yisrael. Back into the Gemara. Omer Rav Yosef bar Min Yumi, Omer Rav Nachman, Rav Yosef bar Min Yumi said in the name of Rav Nachman, Ubavel ki'ir ha'smucho l'svar damya. Bavel is like a city by the border. What do you mean Bavel is like a city that's near the border? So the Gemara says, Tirguma, they explain that it means Neherda. Neherda was a Jewish city in Bavel. Beyond Neherda, there were many towns, villages, hamlets inhabited by Jews. Neherda is by the border. If Goyim come against Neherda, and they're not going to be stopped over there, Goyim will now have free access to all of the little towns, villages, and hamlets beyond. That means this halacha that we're talking about over here has nothing to do with the question of the sacredness, the sanctity, or the holiness of the land. It is a halacha based purely on the question of pikuach nefesh. It can be a border city, any place. I don't know if Borough Park falls, then Flatbush is next. Would be the same halacha. Would be the same halacha. And here it is, Neherda. Neherda is the city that stands in the way of Sonei Yisrael making their way to all sorts of other Jewish communities. So the halacha is, even if they come just for kash, for teven, straw and hay and stubble, you are mechal Shabbos, you take weapons and you go out and fight. Where do we know this halacha of a city on the border? That a city on the border is different. By the way, of course, remember that Gush Katif or Sderot are no different, no less than Neherda, or the border of Lebanon. I mean, we're not talking about something that is in any way, shape or form, related to the sanctity of the land. This is one of the things that was not understood. They thought, and we were accused of being a bunch of wild-eyed mishugoyim that held that a piece of earth is more valuable than a life. That was a blood libel. That was never true. The issue was not this piece of land of Eretz Yisrael is worth more than a life. Of course not. That was not the question. The question is, which side of the line does Pikuach Nefesh lie? Now, what was true about Neherda, can be true about Eretz Yisrael as well. There's never, ever a question, and I'm not saying that this is true of all of those who were opposed to land for peace. There may have been those who said that something as like that. But that was not mainstream thinking. Mainstream thinking was not that you can't give up a afshal. It's not afshal. Question is, where does the pikuach nefesh lie? In giving the land or not giving the land? That's the issue that we're going to have to talk about. Where is the pikuach nefesh? So I say, we never understood. I remember, I can't imagine now how it ever happened, but when I was rabbi at the Young Israel of West Hempstead, this goes back already 35 years. I don't know how they ever agreed. By the way, it is warm, or maybe I'm hot under the collar, but okay, we'll just make ourselves comfortable over here. I came with a coat, you should know. I came with a coat. I thought in the front it's snowing. I came with a coat, and I came with a scarf. And the guy who's driving the bus or the hasa'ah is sitting in a short sleeve shirt. I felt a little silly. But it's better to be warm than silly, you know. Who cares? Let's take a closer look. We haven't been talking about whether a piece of land is worth more than a life. Of course, a life is of infinite value. But I do say there may have been those, and by the way, there is a halachic position of that sort. There was a halachic position. The halachic position was that there's a mitzvah to conquer Eretz Yisrael. But here I started telling you about the West Hempstead, right there. Okay. So I don't know how it happened, but we had Meir Kahana Hashem Yinkom Tamo was guest for Shabbos. I don't know how it happened. Today, most probably they wouldn't. I don't know. I don't know what they would do today. I imagine since I left, they've gone more to the left. When I was there, it was pretty right. Anyway, so in middle of Meir Kahana's speech, one of the leftists gives a cry out, "You mean land is worth more than life?" And he shot back at him, "Would you give up the Kotel?" Understand? This is a classic. He was a great debater. No, the poor fellow was not going to say. He's stuck. He's meeting him on his own turf. All right? You want me to give up Yehuda v'Shomron, Efrat, and all the rest to save lives? Well, wait a minute. Would you give up the Kotel? No self-respecting Jew can say, "Yeah, I'll give up the Kotel." So there it was. It was a classic standoff. But that wasn't. They weren't talking real issues. They were. This was debating. That wasn't the real issue. The real issue was always Pikuach Nefesh. Now let's just finish the piece of Gemara, and then we'll go on to the details of the halacha. The Gemara discusses an example from scripture of an attack upon a border city. Dorosh Rab Dostoy, the Minbiri, Rab Dostoy, the Minbiri says, Maidich Siv, it says, Vayagiru Ledovid Lemor, Hinei Plishtim Nilchomim Vikilov, Vahimoshosim et Hagranot. David is told, this is yet before David has become Melech, and he is roaming around the Negev HaMa'aravi, the Negev, the Western Negev. And if I'm not mistaken, this town, Keilah, was not far from where Sderot is now. It's on the way to Nachal HaBesor. Anyway, the Plishtim were up to their old tricks. Now they're up to their old tricks. Then it was the sort of old tricks. And they came to steal from the threshing floors of Keilah. Keilah was a Jewish community. The threshing floors only had straw and hay and straw and stubble. And what happened was, Tana, we learned, Keilah, on a few lines further, Keilah hira smucha l'sfar haisa, Keilah was a city close by the border, v'hem lo boe el aliske teva v'kash, they only came to take straw and hay, d'chtiv v'hem oshosim et hagranot, they are robbing, they're stealing from the threshing floors. V'uksivin, it says, v'yishal David v'ashem lema, David asked the Rebbeishim, he asked him, Yom v'turim, the Urim v'Tumim, ha'elech v'hiketi v'plishtim ha'ele, shall I go strike these plishtim, smite them? V'yomer Hashem al David, God said to David, leich go v'hikita et ha'plishtim, and you will destroy them, v'hushato et ke'ilah, and you're going to save ke'ilah. So now the Gemara is wondering what's happening over here. It seems quite clear that he's getting permission from God to go out against the Plishtim, who are coming only to steal something that is has financial value and not that much at that, and he's been given permission min hashamayim to go out after them. So the Gemara says, wait a minute, the Urim v'Tumim doesn't pass through Shilas, lo v'hashamayim, he Torah is not in heaven, you can't ask the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol l'shaila. And if it's a question of a shaila whether you're mechalel Shabbos, so there was the Bezdin of Shmuel. From your local Orthodox rabbi. You don't have to go ahead and ask the Urim the Tumim, God should pass in the Shaila. So the Gemara says, indeed that's so. He knew what the halacha is. He knew that the halacha is that by an ear svar, a city on the border, you go out and you mechal Shabbos, even if they're coming only for iske moment, things of financial value. The Shaila that he was asking of the Urim V'Tumim is the kind of question you're supposed to address to the Urim V'Tumim. Will I succeed? Bet Din can't tell you that. God can tell you. And the Rebbe Shem tells him, you're going to succeed. You're going to save the city of Keilah from the hands of the Plishtim. End of Gemara. Okay. the Gemara as is, is clearly expressed as halacha by the Rambam, clearly expressed as halacha in the Shulchan Aruch. It's in Simen Shin Chav Tes in Shulchan Aruch Orachayim, halacha Vav and Zayin. It's all clearly stated there. I have in number 3 the Rambam. We only can read, we have only part of it. Let's go. Goyim Shetzoro Al Yorosh Yisrael, Goyim who besieged the cities of Israel in Bo Al Ishke Mom. And you see, the Rambam also doesn't say Eretz Yisrael, he says cities of Israel. It's not a halacha specifically related to Eretz Yisrael, to land, or to sanctity, or to holiness, or to kibush Eretz. That has nothing to do with it. In Bo Al Ishke Mom, if they come for money, you're not desecrating the Shabbos vein, you don't wage war with them. Ubiir asmucha l'svar, a city that's near a border, afilu lo boil iskei teva v'kashin, if they only come for straw and hay, yotzen alein v'klei zayin v'chalam leis ha-shabbos. And of course, then the Chama goes on, if they come al iskei nefashos, of course in the chal shabbos, you go out and you don't wait, you don't decide, listen, we'll leave Matzah Shabbos, we'll wait till Matzah Shabbos. You have to go immediately, get your weapons and move. And don't leave anything for a minute later. It has to be now. That's the halacha. Number 4, we're going to see part one significant part, and then the next paragraph is going to be an even more significant part of the tshuva of Rav Abadi Yosef.
Now, I have a shayla.
Yes.
It bothers me here.
Yes.
It says, "Goyim she'tzaru al ha'yarot Yisrael ba'u al iski mamon." Minayin. How does a community know when he sees an enemy coming? What's in the mind of that of those enemies?
That's a pretty good question.
How can you be determined? What if they do it? You know.
You know what I'm ready to say? The question is, how do you know whether they're coming for money or they're coming to kill? Mm-hmm. So you know, the fact is that the answer to your question finds its expression in the Shulchan Aruch. Because the Shulchan Aruch and the halacha after this, I believe the Shulchan Aruch there says that today, in other words, there was once a day that there were fine ganavim. There was a time that people stole. People stole. And then there were vilga murderers. The Shulchan Aruch already, a few hundred years after the Gemara, 1,000 years after the Gemara, already says that now, whenever they come, we have to be concerned. We have to be concerned that it will turn into pikuach nefesh. Mm-hmm. Because, and even the Rishonim already talked about it. They said, what happens if there's going to be somebody who doesn't want to let him take his money? I mean, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Chayin Tal, it says, chazok, a person is not going to stand idly by while they take. Come to take his money, even though on Shabbos the halacha would have been that you should give to him what he wants to take rather than be mechal Shabbos, but people may not do it, so that the iske mamon is naturally going to turn into iske nefashos. It's going to become a matter of life and death. But it seems that there was a time. Listen, I remember a time when you could walk through any street in Manhattan any time of day or night without fear of being mugged. I remember that. I know I'm ancient. You maybe never experienced that. Wait a minute, don't we remember times that it was even safe in Toronto? It's so safe in Toronto today. Not safe. There was a period of time that was a different mentality. But it's a good akasha. So, Adarabi, you're making things better. In other words, there is no such thing really as coming out of this gate and having a kasha. That's what you're saying. They come, they want to kill. They want to kill. All right. That was the Rama. The Bavadio Sage brings Vine Rashi Shom Pidesh. He brings the Rashi. And here's going to become fascinating. Number one, you know, we don't have to read it inside. Tell you, he brings Rashi. Rashi says, because a border city is different, because if the border city is going to fall, then it opens up the way for these goyim to attack all sorts of other villages and hamlets where Jews are there. And he does bring, what's significant, is he brings the first Mishnah in the Masechta Sanhedrin says, can you imagine, listen to this, what an amazing halacha. There's a halacha that says, in the Torah tells us, an ir hanidachat, a city in which every last adult in the city worshipped idols, a bunch of idol worshippers. The halacha is that that city has to be destroyed utterly, and all of the people put to death, and all of the possessions of that city are supposed to be brought to the city square and burned, destroyed, everything, completely destroyed. So the first Mishnah Sanhedrin says, but if this city of idolaters is on the border, no such halacha. No such halacha. Because even those idolaters, they stand there and protect the rest of Eretz Yisrael from the enemy. You understand? The interesting halacha, the halacha says that that if the city has one mezuzah, you don't destroy the city. So there was, I remember years ago, there were those who said that, listen, if there's no mezuzah in the city, a Chabad school would get into the city and put up a mezuzah. And then they said, but if there was one mezuzah, somebody else from some other Hasidus will make his way in and take down the mezuzah. Two different approaches. Ulam Haravan, number 5. This is where it gets very exciting. Here it becomes exciting because here it comes to why I am revisiting the question to begin with. There are assumptions that may have been made at one point in time, and maybe those assumptions are no longer true. There may have been ideas that were really readily accepted, but no, the reality has changed. That's why halacha has to be looked at again and again. Maybe the reality has changed. Just as the question you asked, the reality changed with regard to people coming to steal money. What are you talking about? How many robberies have ended up in murders? I mean, this has become it's the norm. Ulam Haravan Pireish. The Ravan was the Zeda of the Rosh, Rabbeinu Osher. Ravan Pireish. Now listen to this. Not like Rashi. Rashi says the reason why a border city has to be defended at all costs is because if the border city falls, then that leaves open all sorts of other Jewish communities to the enemy. The Ravan looks at it from a completely different point of view. He says, when Goyim come against a border city, even if they're only coming to steal, they're going to be ready to kill. Do you know why they will be ready to kill? Because they can immediately run back to their own people and be protected. Now, if this is the border city, Rashi is looking at what's going to happen on the Jewish side of the border. This falls, that's open. The Ravan is looking at it from the point of view, there are the Goyim. They're coming to steal. And they're ready to kill. You know why they're ready to kill? Because they will immediately go back after they've done what they've done, and they're going to be protected by their people. You know, they may even surround the house that Tzahal wants to bomb. And there will be protection there. All right, that's the Ravan's approach. So it's fascinating. Rashi is looking in one direction, and the Ravan is looking back. They can immediately run back. Okay, now watch. Here we have to read it. Shekivish Yismuchel is far, because it's close to the border. Im Yamdu Yisrael Omamonam, if Israel will stand up to protect their money, Yahargum, they will kill them. Velo Yiro, they're not going to be afraid to kill. Because they're close to other goyim and they can immediately run back for protection. The siyim, and the Ravan ends by saying, "Koshkein onu sheyoshim betocham." Here he's already expressing the idea we just said. We who live amongst goyim, the Ravan is about 1,000 years ago. We who live amongst goyim, they're certainly not going to be afraid to kill us. So there's no such thing as they're coming only for Tevin Vakash. Lachem Chalim Alemus HaShabbos Lahatzil. Here already in the Ravam, we have already the halacha that they may always be coming to kill. Now listen to this. According to the pshat of the Ravan, shebizmanenu, in our time, she'en lahem makom lanus, they have no place where to flee to. Kivan shebezat Hashem yesh itanu matosei krav, because we have fighter planes, we have, and you know what will happen if they attack? Sheyuchlu lahamrile merchakim gedolim toch takot sfurot, they can fly long distances in moments, ulav tzitz et ha'ivim albatem, and to bomb the enemy in their houses, im yinasul of God, betoshevei eretz, it's also going to try to hurt us. There's no difference between an ear asmuchel asfar and not. Is that the reality? Has Rabbi Avadi Yosef expressed the reality? In other words, he says, Goyim are going to be afraid to come into Eretz Yisrael to kill, because we have jet planes. And the moment they come, we're going to go after them and destroy them. That's not the reality. Maybe it was the reality as Rabbi Avadi Yosef saw it at the time that he wrote this tshuva, which might have been about 30 years ago. That's not the reality today. Certainly not what the Oslo Accords. It couldn't have been the reality, because we surrendered the right to hot pursuit. We're not going to enter into the territory of the Palestinian Authority in hot pursuit of terrorists. We gave them. It all falls. The whole halacha falls. The reality has changed. It's just plain different. When I say that we have to reassess, and here we're talking about the landmark tshuva of land for peace. That's not the reality. Reality has changed. If the reality has changed, we have to look at it from a completely different point of view. What's really difficult with Rabbi Avadi Yosef is all of the Rishonim paskin like Rashi. All of the Rishonim paskin like Rashi, that an ir svar, a border city, your chal shabbos for a border city, is so that it should not leave Eretz Yisrael open. All the Rishonim paskin like Rashi. The Ravan, and most probably the Ravan is not disagreeing with Rashi. Nobody disagrees with Rashi on this halacha. If anything, the Ravan is giving another reason. But that the Ravan's reason should become the reason, and on the basis of that say that we can give up land. Very difficult to accept it. You know, any Americans over here? No, because I see Canadians. Any American? Can anybody here tell me what's the meaning of Tippecanoe and Tyler too? Yes?
Campaign slogan in 1840 for William Henry Harrison.
Find a piece of candy. I give you something. Excellent. Excellent. It was the campaign slogan in 1840 for William Henry Harrison and Tyler. John Tyler.
His vice president.
Yeah. William Henry Harrison was running for president of the United States. His running mate was Tyler, John Tyler. So somebody came up with a brilliant slogan. 29 years earlier, William Henry Harrison won a great victory over the Indians at a place called Tippecanoe. 800 Indians, Shamna Macharpa. That's what he became a big hero for. So here it's 1840 now, it's 29 years later. He's running for office. And somebody came up with this slogan, Tippecanoe. Everybody understood Tippecanoe is Harrison, and Tyler too. and in hundreds of thousands of homes in America. Tippa Canoe in Tyler too. He won hands down. One of the historians, right? That was the historic moment at which voters stopped thinking forever. It was no longer important to think about what does he stand for, what does his owner stand for. A slogan. Tippecanoe and Tyler too. I hold that we have to be very, very careful not to fall into the trap of sloganeering and sloganisms, because we're suffering from it terribly. The most nonsensical slogan of all has been "Land for Peace." Nobody ever was ready to give us peace for land unless land means all of the land. Mm-hmm. It was never really true. It was a slogan. And as slogans go, they sort of are the entree. They open up the door to a certain social strata. A person who was for land for peace, a liberal, a thinker, a man who's not set in his ways, has an openness to the world. Boy, for land for peace, you just moved into a completely different part of society. Slogans can be extremely dangerous. Dangerous is not the word. Slogans can destroy. Charles M. Schulz, hat einmal gesagt. Charles M. Schulz said, politics and philosophy are not bumper stickers. You can't come along with a bumper sticker slogan and that's a policy or a philosophy. It has to be well thought out. Wendell Willkie. What did Wendell Willkie say? A slogan puts real thought back 50 years. Slogans are dangerous. By the way, there are good slogans and there are bad slogans. I hold that the greatest slogan in all of history was the Rabbeinu Shlomo's own slogan, "Let my people go." I think "Let my people go" has inspired nearly every fight for freedom in all of history. "Let my people go." What, the Solidarity Sunday in the United States, 2, 4, 6, 8, open up the iron gate, "Let my people go." You think that that slogan did not help to bring down the mighty Soviet Empire? It came crumbling down like a deck of cards. "Let my people go." There are sometimes, I remember Williamsburg. I grew up in Williamsburg during the Second World War. And I remember there were big, what do you call those big signs? I forgot. Billboards? That's right, good. I needed the word billboards. There were billboards showing a troop ship going down in the Atlantic and "Loose lips sink ships." Powerful. As a little boy, I remember "loose lips sink ships." Boy, you have to watch out. Now, there are sometimes two-word slogans. I think the most memorable one in my lifetime was "unconditional surrender." The Allies, Roosevelt, Churchill, Stalin, "unconditional surrender." There will be no peace talks with Germany or Japan. Utterly destroy them. You know what Roosevelt's problem was? He didn't have one of our chachumim telling him, "Ein pitaron tzva'i," there is no military solution. Poor nut. Roosevelt didn't know that there's no military solution. So he had no choice but to crush Germany and Japan. That's a very dangerous slogan. "Ein pitaron tzva'i," there is no military solution. Very dangerous. Not thought out at all. Or one of them that just came to the surface again this week. What came to the surface this week? "Restraint is strength." Ipuk ze kavach. Ipuk is costing us right now all the weaponry that's getting into Gaza. It cost us 5 years of Hezbollah. We knew. Anybody, all you had to do, you didn't have to be a genius. All you had to do was read the Jerusalem Post. And every so often, and you didn't, not even Carolyn Glick. Not even Carolyn Glick. By the way, that was the great part of my trip to Canada. You wanted a story? I was at a Mizrahi dinner. And the guest speaker was Carolyn Glick. And she sat at the same table with me. I told her, Carolyn, you understand, I'm going to come home and tell my wife I'm on a first-name basis with Carolyn. She was great. She's in her middle 30s. She needs a shidduch badly. She's so bright. She's wonderful. She's very bright. The slogans, it's unbelievable. Ipuk ze koach. It's not koach. It's terrible weakness. So if you read the Jerusalem Post, and I say without reading Carolyn Glick, you knew that weapons were coming in from Syria to Hezbollah. All along, we knew it. We even knew the number of rockets that they had. Slogans are very dangerous. Land for peace is nothing more than an empty slogan that has caused such harm. And what more the harm is, by thinking that the ones who are ready to give up land for peace are the ones who care about Jewish lives. And those of us who say, no, we're not concerned with Jewish lives, here is where the reassessment has to take place. Is it possible or very probable that if land would not have been given up, there would be more Jews alive today? Let's take a look at it. I mean, it may very well be that that is the truth. We have lost lives every time we gave land. And now we're talking about, or Prime Minister is talking about it again, but I'm not talking politics. I want to talk halacha. Rav Shaul Yisraeli is going to make one point, and I'll tell you the truth. I always understood it that way. Rav Avadya Yosef is going to say, when it comes to the question to decide whether we give up land, this is a decision that has to be made by the military people, by the politicians, certainly not the rabbis. Okay? Military men and politicians. So Rav Shaul Yisraeli says, wait a minute. Here's the whole Gemara in Erevin. Goyim are coming on Iskei Nefashos. The Gemara says you take weapons and go out and fight. Why doesn't the Gemara say, let's ask the military men and the politicians? I mean, why all of a sudden does this appear today on the scene? Why didn't the Gemara say whether they're coming, whether Goyim are coming against us because they want to steal, or they're coming to kill? Maybe the first thing that we have to do is ask the politicians, the statesmen. Statesmen, why not? Where did this halacha come from? So Rav Shaul Yisraeli says what I believe to be the truth. I had always understood it that way. Chazal made an assessment 2,000 years ago that's valid for all time. The halacha, the Gemara in Erevin and the Shulchan Aruch in Shin Chav Tes is saying, if they're coming for Kash V'Tevin, you can bet your bottom dollar they're coming for lives. Well, why don't we just give them the city when they come? Give it to them. That never occurred to the Gemara. Give up the city. Let's go. What do we need it for? That never occurred to the Gemara. And it never occurred to the Gemara to say, no, that this is a question that has to be decided upon by generals and politicians. And the question on Rav Avadya Yosef is even greater. He has another tshuva elsewhere where he says that if it's a medical question whether to eat on Yom Kippur or not, so he says you cannot depend on a chiloni doctor. You have to ask a doctor, shomer Torah u'mitzvahs, before you can decide that the patient has to eat on Yom Kippur. Why should it be different? Why, if that is what he says with regard to eating on Yom Kippur, why should it be different with regard to this question of a pikuach nefesh of Kol Yisrael? Maybe you cannot trust a general whose whole philosophy about Eretz Yisrael is completely different. Maybe he's ready to give it up because it has no value to him. Maybe he sees it only as real estate. I mean, these are serious questions that have to be dealt with and taken into the hopper. But I must say, in Rabbi Ovadia Yosef's defense, his maskona, number 8, I don't think anybody read it. Nobody ever read it. This is the most carefully written and reasoned sentence in the tshuva. Hamura mikol ha'omer, what we take out of all that was said, in yidbarel l'mala me'al kol safek, if it will become clear beyond any doubt, sheyesh shalom emet beineinu l'veshcheineinu, that there will be real peace between us and our neighbors, ha'aravim, im yurzuru l'hem ha'shtachim, if we give them the territory, ulum atzot. Now the second part is also extremely important. And if not, if we don't, there's a sakana of immediate war, milchama miyaditim lo yuzu vem hashtachim, yesh lahazil hem hashtachim, mishum she'en lecha dover homi b'fnei pikuach nefesh, because nothing stands in the way of pikuach nefesh. He made it dependent on knowing beyond any shadow of a doubt that there is going to be real peace. Has there been any moment in all of our history that was possible? It was never possible. It never fell into the realm of reality. I'll tell you what stage we're at. Remember once, it just blew my mind away. In Parshat Vayishlach, we're going to come to the nocturnal struggle between Yaakov and the Malach. Now, what's the story? He doesn't know it's a Malach. Who does he think this fellow is? So Rashi brings the Gemara that says that he had taken his family across the Yabok River, but he left some pachim katanim, he left little jugs, really not terribly valuable. He left them on the other side, so he went back to get his jugs. And he's accosted by a man who engages him in struggle. He assumes, Yaakov Avinu assumes, that the man wants the little jars, the pachim katanim, the small jars. But the struggle is going on for hours. It's nearly morning. Forgive, I don't know, the pun or the twist of a sentence. As it comes near to morning, Yaakov turns to him, and this is the Gemara. The Gemara says, he asked him, V'chiganev ata o kubyustus ata? Are you a thief or a murderer? It dawns on Yaakov Avinu that this man didn't come to steal the Pachim Ketanim. You know what he wants? He wants Yaakov. The Pachim Ketanim are an excuse. The Iske Mammon is an excuse. What he really wants is Yaakov. That's the question that we have to ask ourselves. What does he want? And we have to reach the point at which we realize it may not be an issue over land altogether. I think that should have dawned on us a long, long time ago, but I'm being nice. And then there's another pasuk here that just wiped me out when I thought of it. Vayar ki lo yachalo, that Malach sees that he's not able, I'm reading in the Chumash, you don't have this there. He saw that he can't get Yaakov, so he strikes him in his thigh, Vayomer. And you know what the Malach says to him? This most probably was the worst blow to Yaakov, more than the blow to his thigh. Vayomer, this unknown man says to him, Shalcheni, send me away, ki ola hashachar, because dawn has risen. If I'd be Yaakov, I'd be standing there. Wait a minute. Who started this fight? Do you know what he's done in the one word, Shalcheni? Shalcheni, he has turned the tables completely on Yaakov. He has turned Yaakov into the aggressor who's fighting with him, and Yaakov, Shalcheni. Wait a minute, that was never the story. Hey, wait, you don't got a right. You don't got a right at all. I didn't start out with you. I was minding my own business. I came here to get my little jaws, and you attacked me. Shalcheni. That's a brilliant, brilliant ruse to turn the victim into the aggressor. And all of a sudden, the attacker has now turned it into a cycle of violence. Condoleezza Rice's cycle, the whole world's cycle of riot. You know, we're cycle, their cycle, him cycle, her cycle. It's not so. It's not so at all. Yaakov Avinu was attacked. One final one final point. And that's going to be number 10. I remember having said this, also, when I thought about it, I think it was yesterday, September 9th, 1993 was the day on which Rabin read the letter that he had received from Arafat that PLO recognizes the State of Israel. That was the 9th of September. The next day was the 10th of September. Shabbos was the 11th. Monday was the 13th. That was the day of the handshake on the White House lawn. So Shabbos was 9/11, right? It was the 11th day. By us Israelis, it was the 11th day of the 9th month. Shabbos was 9/11. I remember the drasha that I said on 9/11. In other words, ich bin schon an alter right-wing extremist. I'll tell you exactly what I said that Shabbos. It's based on a few psukim here at the end of Parshas Chukas. The Torah tells us the story of the struggle between Sichon, Melech, Hamodi, and Klal Yisrael. Yisrael sent Malachim to Sichon, king of the Amori, saying, let me go through your land, I won't take anything, I'll go on the straight road. Anyway, Sichon says no. He comes out with his army against the Jewish people, and there's a major battle, and Klal Yisrael crushes Sichon. Look at Pasuk Chaf Hey. Vayikach Yisrael kol ha'arim ha'ela. Yisrael took all of the cities. Vayeshiv Yisrael b'chol ha'ari Amori, and Yisrael settled in all the cities of the Amori. B'cheshbon u'b'chol benoteha, in Cheshbon and all of the surrounding towns. Ki Cheshbon ir Sichon melech ha'amori, because Cheshbon was the city of Sichon, king of the Amori. That was his city. V'hu nilcham. You know when he conquered Cheshbon, he waged war with the first king of Moab, and he took Kol Arzo Miyodo Ad Arnon. Alkain, listen to this. Alkain Yonu HaMoshlim, therefore, the balladeers, those who write the poems of war, say, Bo Cheshbon, come to Cheshbon, Tibona de Tikone near Sichon. How much it sounds like Yerushalayim. Tibona de Tikone. Let it be built and established, the city of Sichon. Kiyesh Yotso mi Cheshbon, because fire went out of Cheshbon. Lehova mi Kiryat Sichon. Flames went out of the metropolis of Sichon, and it consumed Or of Moab and Baleg Omot Arnon. I want to know, what does it do for our Yiddishkeit to know that Cheshbon was the city of Sichon? And what happens if I wouldn't know it? All right. What happens if I wouldn't know that he waged war with the first king of Moab and he took Cheshbon? What's this Al Kain Yomram? What's going on over there? What does it mean? I mean, there are psukim in Torah that we have to understand. They must mean something. Nachem al Cheshbon. Nachem al Cheshbon. Fire went out of Cheshbon. So I'm going to tell you a vote that I heard from my Chashiva days I was learning in Ner Yisroel, Rabbi Yaakov Yitzhak Halevi, Rudeman Zechet Tzadik Levocha. This is 50 years ago. Thank God that I remember something from 50 years ago. There's a famous Gemara in Bava Basra where the Gemara says, Al kein yomru ha-moshlim, the word moshlim, not from the word balladeer or sayer of moshels, but Al kein yomru ha-moshlim, Elu ha-moshlim b'yitzchom, those who rule over their inclination. You know what they say? Bo cheshbon, come, let us make na'aseh cheshbono shel olam. Let's make the great accounting. What is the great accounting? Schar mitzvah keneged hefsedo. What is the reward for a mitzvah, and what do you lose by doing a mitzvah? And then on the other hand, what's the great reward of doing an avera? Oh, and what's going to be the loss of Harry? What are they talking about? What does that beautiful Gemara have to do with the word Moshlim? The Rashiva said the following. I don't remember if he said it was a medrash or whatever. I certainly didn't find a medrash like that. He says the following. Sichon lines up his forces. He's getting ready to attack Moab. You know what Cheshbon is? Cheshbon is a border town. Cheshbon is a flea-bitten, one-horse town. It's got one main street. There's a saloon with sliding doors. There's a lockup. And there's a, well, probably a general store. General store. Nothing much going on in Cheshbon. It's Pashit. It's the end of the world. That's what Cheshbon is. I mean, that's what the Rosh Yeshiva said, not in as graphic terminology as I did. So there was a meeting of the high command of Moab. What should we do? Are we going to send forces to defend Cheshbon? We're going to make a war over Cheshbon? Let this guy Sichon have his Cheshbon. Who cares? It's not worth that we should send our soldiers there and men and material and equipment. So they made a strategic withdrawal and set up their line of defense about 20 kilometers beyond Cheshbon. So comes the day, Sichon marches in to Cheshbon without shooting an arrow. And then you know what he does? He bides his time. He begins to bring in men, material, weaponry, and by the way, he doesn't have to dig tunnels. He can bring it straight in. And you know what he did? He turned Cheshbon into a fortress of such power and such strength. Did you know what happened? Eish Yotzami Cheshbon, fire went down from Cheshbon, flames from Kiryat Sichon, and destroyed Moab. They gave up that strategic little spot. What's it have to do with the Gemara? What it has to do with the Gemara is, the Yetzer Hara never comes to a Jew and says, I want you to eat a McDonald's on Yom Kippur Shechalias B'Shabbos. A place of McDonald's. No. The Yetzer Hara has a different approach. The Yetzer Hara comes to a Jew and he says, you know, you got to talk a little Lashon Hara about that guy. And by the way, of course, the Yetzer Hara convinces him that guy's a lowlife, he's a garnished. You know what? It's a mitzvah to talk Lashon Hara about him. So the guy goes ahead and he talks Lashon Hara. The Yetzer Hara is off and running. He's laughing because he just established a beachhead in that person's neshama. A few weeks later, another seduction, another little avera, Eish Yotzom Echeshbon, until ultimately a man is consumed and destroyed. The Rosh Yeshiva, of course, was telling a Dvar Musar. But his Talmud, 40 years later or 35 years later, who's living in Eretz Yisrael, takes a look at this word and says, not only the Nimshal is true, the Mashal is true. You give up the flea-bitten little Cheshbon. What? When was the last time you were in Yericho? What? The next thing we'll hear is, when's the last time you were in Sderot? No. Not the way it works. That's not the way it works. Cheshbon is important because Cheshbon is establishing an extremely significant principle for the defense of a Jew from the Yetzer Hara and for the defense of Klal Yisrael from its enemies. You stand firm. You stand fast. Any weakening of the position is one that is going to simply make us weaker, and certainly seem a great deal weaker in the eyes of our enemies. That's Al Kem Yomru HaMoshlim. I'm using the modern muscle of Al Kem Yomru HaMoshlim. Bo Cheshbon. Think about Cheshbon. No piece of land is just flea-bitten and insignificant. Every piece of land can be turned into a place of great significance. A flea-bitten place can also be turned into a Garden of Eden of great beauty, and there are others who will come and destroy it. Cheshbon is the great story, I believe, of the Jewish people of today. What I wanted to accomplish is, number one, remove, at least in the minds of some people, the blood libel. We never thought that a piece of earth is worth more than the life of an Israeli soldier. That was never the issue at all. On the contrary, it had nothing to do with that at all. The issue was, where does the pikuach nefesh lie? Will giving up land save lives, or will giving up land cost lives? We said it will cost lives. Others said it will save lives. I think the facts are in. We know what the truth is. It's also important to know that Shulchan Aruch has a very clear look. As Rav Shaul Yisraeli says, this was a value judgment that was made by Chazal, and that value judgment remains in fact true ad hayom hazeh, until today. It remains true. It means also that Rabbanim, yeah, we do have an opinion, at least as good as anybody else. And maybe above all, I think that we have to learn that we cannot allow ourselves to be swept away by empty sloganeering. And if you watch the newspapers, listen to speeches, and you will be able to begin to identify what's Tippa Canoe and Tyler II and what's Let My People Go. Nobody died because of Tippa Canoe and Tyler II, but land for peace, there is no military solution. Restraint is strength. These are slogans that are extremely dangerous. So we have to be awake. We have to be aware. We have to be able to think. We have to see through what's being thrown at us, because there's a constant attempt to really brainwash us to see things in a particular way. Sometimes it takes a great deal of strength and a great deal of intelligence to be able to say, no, that's not true. It's not true. It's just plain not true. So we have to take our cue from Yaakov Avinu. It has to dawn on us. Do you want land or do you want our lives? We have to give that answer. Erev Tov.
One of the slogans I always use.